Good morning. It is Tuesday, May 7th at 8 o'clock, and you've tuned into the morning show here on 88.5 KRFY. I'm Jack Peterson, and this is the first of a three-part special series that we're doing in the morning show. This and each of the following Tuesdays, we will be exploring the worth of a woman with the Pro Voice Project and special guests. Jen Jackson Quintano is here, and from the Pro Voice Project. She's the founder and executive director, and each week we'll take a different look at a different aspect of reproductive health care and how it impacts community health, including talking to a historian today, but also we'll be talking to an economist, a legislator, and local residents, coinciding with the unveiling of the Worth of a Woman display at Bluebird Bakery and with an event this weekend at the library. But first, I will properly introduce Jen Jackson Quintano, who's the founder and executive director of the Pro Voice Project. Good morning, Jen. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It is, it's great to have you here. And we have a rather full agenda today because we have a long conversation with Professor Jennifer Hill coming up in just a minute. So without any further ado, can you tell us, for those who have never heard of it, what is the Pro Voice Project? When did you guys get started, and what is it today?
Yeah, happy to do that. And I like your lead in for those who might not have heard of it, as if this is ubiquitous and everywhere. So the Pro Voice Project, I began this organization in the wake of the Dobbs decision, which was when Roe v. Wade was overturned. And we started seeing state abortion bans, trigger bans going into effect, like we saw here in Idaho. And I just felt like something was called for in the wake of that moment, and that the experience of agency and autonomy with one's body and the experience of the abortion journey, it doesn't fit very well within the confines of the political realm. And my background is in writing, and I firmly believe in the power of story. So I decided to bring personal narratives to the issue of reproductive rights, reproductive health care, abortion. And the project started here in Sandpoint with a number of area women sending me their stories about their abortions. And we put on a stage performance of those stories with actors performing them. And it was really powerful. We had nearly 200 people come out to see this in Sandpoint. And it's just grown from there. I think there is a hunger to talk about this issue outside the realm of politics, outside of that binary, that black and white, good and bad, and to understand that abortion is complicated. Pregnancy is complicated. We as human beings are very complicated. There is nothing black or white about our experience. So the opportunity to hear Idahoan stories and, you know, walk in their shoes for a moment or two and to understand their experience, I think it's been really healing for a lot of people and has promoted a little more empathy and understanding. And then also a part of this storytelling campaign and these stage productions is coming up against these mechanisms of shame and stigma and silence that surround talk of women's bodies, reproductive health care, abortion specifically. It's really important to be talking about this stuff if we're going to understand it.
Yeah. How's the response been locally and also statewide? You've been doing some travel, too.
Yeah, I've been doing some travel. We've put on the stage performance in four communities around the state, and we have five more planned for this year. And there have been a number of speaking engagements, writing workshops, other events around the state. And everyone assumes that this is really dangerous work, and they're asking about threats to me for talking about abortion because it seems so scary. And I want to go on record as saying the response has been so heartwarming and receptive, and people are grateful that we are talking about this. in a way that doesn't involve the vitriol and the back and forth, the anger. People are grateful to hear stories that reflect their own experience or that open their eyes to the experience of others. People have really embraced this. And I would say 99% of the response to this statewide has been gratitude and excitement to be talking about these things that we haven't been speaking of prior to this. So that's been really hopeful for me to hear that and to receive that response.
That is surprising to me, I would say. Do you hear from people who are even people who are maybe on the supportive of some of the legislative decisions that the state legislature has taken? Do you hear any response from them, either negative or otherwise?
I mean, I have definitely heard from. Well, the interesting thing about this conversation, let me rewind a little bit.
Okay.
As everyone here knows, we lost our labor and delivery department here at Bonner General almost exactly a year ago. And I think as tragic as that was, it was also a means of highlighting how these bans, even if you consider yourself pro-life, how these bans have a negative impact and how they impact communities like ours, how they impact physicians in this state. And so you can be someone who has never considered yourself supportive of abortion, but you can also see that banning abortion in nearly all instances has negative ramifications. And so we've seen nearly a quarter of our reproductive health care providers in this state leave just in the last 16 to 18 months, and only two have moved in state. It's a really difficult environment for physicians to work in, knowing that their actions, that them providing the standard of care, that can be criminalized, and they could go to jail for that. So this is a way to bring more people into this conversation, to see like, oh my goodness, I can't safely birth a baby here. I don't have those supports with an obstetrician here, or my daughter can't do that. We've also lost all of our gynecologists. It's difficult to access just basic reproductive health care here. So we're all feeling the impacts, and we're all seeing that healthcare in general is too complicated to legislate. We need our physicians to be making these decisions on a case-by-case basis. And so I think there are people coming into this conversation and they're grateful that we're talking about this because it helps them to understand the complexities of this and that their quote unquote pro-life stance is compatible with also wanting these laws to be changed.
As I mentioned, we have a jam-packed show here. We don't have that much time to talk about what else the Pro-Voice Project has been going, has been up to. Let's talk about the Worth of a Woman project that's coming up.
Yeah.
Starting on May 10th and then continuing on the 13th.
Yeah. So we, for months now, the Pro-Voice Project, with the help of so many generous, dedicated, amazing volunteers, we've been compiling information, doing a lot of research for this exhibit that's called Worth of a Woman. And it looks at, we're putting this up on the 1 year anniversary of having lost labor and delivery services here, having lost our OBGYNs. And it's a chance for us to reflect on how we value women in their healthcare in our community and in the nation at large. It looks at the contributions that women have made to our community from Lost in the 50s to the Panetta Theater to the Arboretum, all these things that women have banded together and created for our community. And then how are we valuing the care that we give them in response to that? And we're looking at the legal barriers that stand in the way of accessing care. We're looking at the rising maternal mortality rates that we're seeing in Idaho and nationwide. We look at what I mentioned before, the shame and stigma and silence that often stand as barriers to women accessing the care that they need. And we're looking ahead to the future, like how do we fix this problem? How do we shift our approach to reproductive health care? One aspect that we look at is how we've traditionally undervalued and understudied women's healthcare specifically. So this exhibit has 8 panels that are a part of it that will be up around Bluebird Bakery. It will be available starting on Mother's Day, which feels appropriate, this coming Sunday. And people can take as deep a dive they want with this exhibit, examining the panels. It's really beautiful. Emily Erickson here locally has done the layout and design, and she's done a phenomenal job. We also have an artist from Spokane, Carly Fairbanks, that's donated use of her artwork to this, and it's really compelling work. So this exhibit will be up at Bluebird for a month, and it has an attendant website, worthofawomanidaho.com, where you can take deeper dives into these topics that we're exploring.
It starts with a conversation on May 10th at the East Bonner County Library with Professor Jennifer Hill. And she was nice enough to give us a call on the phone, and we talked for about 45 minutes, and we'll be playing that conversation in just a minute with the professor. But what do we expect from the event on May 10th? And how did you encounter Jennifer Hill in the first place?
Yeah, when we first started doing research for this exhibit, we were kind of looking at the past, the reproductive health care we've enjoyed in the past here in Bonner County was how it got started, and comparing that to what we have presently. And Dr. Hill has a book called Birthing the West, where she looks at the history of childbirth and reproduction in the American West, you know, in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And her book was a fantastic resource for us as we were doing this research. And then we learned that she lived in Bozeman, which isn't that far away. And it just seemed like she would be a great fit if she was willing to come to Sandpoint and speak to her research. And she was more than willing to come. So, yeah, she's coming this Friday to speak at the library. And we're really excited about that.
It should be an interesting conversation or an interesting talk from her. And it was an interesting conversation, which our listeners are about to hear. I'm going to play it right now, and we'll be back at the end of this before the top of the hour to respond a little bit to it. And without further ado, we'll be talking to Professor Jennifer Hill. We're on the phone now with Dr. Jennifer Hill. Dr. Hill holds a PhD in American Studies and is currently Associate Teaching Professor at Montana State University. Her research and writing focus on childbirth, contraception, pregnancy, venereal disease, and reproductive health care in the American West, based on a belief that history is a powerful tool for understanding current controversies. Her book, Birthing the West, investigates the history of childbirth in the rural American West, documenting a ubiquitous yet invisible experience. She utilizes an innovative methodology to address the history of public health institutions and medical practices, demonstrating the importance of recovering silent voices and explaining recurring patterns in American culture and reproductive medicine. I'm Jack Peterson, and I'm also here with Jen Jackson Quintano of the Pro Voice Project, and thank you both for being here. I'll turn it over to Jen.
Yeah, thanks for having us today, Jack. And thanks for being here, Jennifer. And I just wanted to start with a general question about how you became interested in reproductive history. It doesn't seem like there are many scholars out there that are studying this. So how did this come to you as your field of study?
Well, thanks to you both, and thanks to all your listeners for tuning in on what is, I think, a very important topic in terms of how I got into this. I happen to be an academic and also to have a uterus. And so I was very aware of the fact that when I was pregnant, I have 3 kids and actually had just 3 pregnancies, but people treated me wildly differently. Like my pregnant belly sort of dominated how people perceived me. And I also noticed how this was something that I didn't find a lot of academic literature about. And so it seemed to me this really different cultural space, certainly as I experienced it as a pregnant woman. And it just seemed strange to me that, you know, one of the things we all share is a belly button. We all got here through birth. And so this is a totally universal human experience. And yet there was so little information out there in terms of the history of it. So as a historian, I said, oh my goodness, I'm uniquely positioned. I really want to know about what this was like for people in the past, especially since it was something I had experienced personally and knew that it was a very different cultural space to be in, given how people reacted to me, the stories that random people came up and shared with me in the grocery store just because I was obviously pregnant, etc. And then once I started looking into it, I got more and more interested in it because of A, how little work had been done, and also B, how very apparent it became that this was something so vitally important. And so it felt as if it was a real, a striking silence in the history that was really important for us to know more about.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. We all have belly buttons, right? We all come into the world in this way. This ubiquitous experience, but it is not something that's talked about in the historical record. You know, I came across this in our own museum here trying to look at the history of birthing care and services here in Bonner County over the years, and very difficult to come by. Occasional newspaper articles, or either that, or you just had to listen to a lot of oral histories and hope that someone brought up her birthing experience. How was it for you? What were your research methods? Where did you find this hidden history?
Well, that's part of the challenge, because unlike a history of war, for example, there aren't people who are regularly out there saying, this is important, we need to get histories of this. So I had to do sort of exactly like what you're talking about, these kind of accidental history searches. And what had been done is in the 1970s, 1980s, folks realized that for a lot of, you know, what we referred to as quote unquote pioneers, that they were all dying and that these were important stories. And so a lot of oral histories were done at that time with people who were very elderly at the time. And so it was a process of going back and pulling these little shreds of evidence, or at least what I thought of as shreds of evidence initially, to find these accidental mentions of birthing experiences. A couple of things that were striking in doing that was that, first of all, no one collects, or at least in most of the research institutions that I looked at, no one had collected birthing material. It was all scattered all over. But what was notable is that as I began searching for these, what I initially thought of as scraps or shreds or something, they started popping out of the woodwork. They were everywhere. So when people were asked about their life experiences, it was so striking how important birth, reproduction, children were. And so people just inserted this information when interviewers were asking them about it, whether people were asking about it specifically or not. In fact, very few of this whole oral history project across the American West really included specific questions about birth and reproduction, but people talked about it a lot of times anyway. So it was laborious in terms of finding these. But once I realized how important this was to people who were recording their oral histories and how often they made mention of it, my perspective radically changed. Instead of thinking about, oh, this is an interesting anecdote here, or this is an interesting anecdote there, all of a sudden it became apparent that this was a central, meaningful experience for settlers in the American West, and that reproduction, childbirth, family were at the core of what really mattered to them. So I used oral histories, certainly, which, as I mentioned, was a very lengthy process that involved searching all over the place and pulling together all of the resources that I could find. But then I also put that together with things like diaries and correspondence. And then the other thing I pulled that ended up really shifting the story was health department records. So health departments in the American West really started in the early 1900s. And one of the things that they were trying to do is to figure out, well, what is going on out there? And so they started collecting all sorts of information about birth. And I was able to pull those records also and then put all of that together. Some of this very personal perspectives on reproduction with this larger aggregated data from state health departments to put together a more cohesive body of work that could actually say something about mm-hmm. people's experience.
And what in your mind does it say about people's experience?
Well, I wrote a book about it. It says a lot of stuff about people's experience that is complex in so many ways, and especially given your listeners and your situation is so relevant for so many of us today. So what it said were, you know, there's this long list. If I were to pull out some of the most important things, it says that relational connected experiences are at the core of human meaning. So we often think about charting the history of something in terms of conflicts or the economic situation or sort of things that are happening on the national level. And really, when it comes down to it, at least for most of us in the past and I think in the present, so much of it is about who we care about, who we spend our days with, what we are connected to in so many of those different ways. And it was absolutely the same for people historically. And so the centrality of these kinds of kinship or supportive, it wasn't necessarily always with blood relatives. It could be found family, etc. But these kinds of relationships were really the things that made community for people that were trying to start and build settler colonial communities in the American West. I think the other significant takeaway, there's a list of them, but the other thing that's top of mind right now is how important it was to recognize women as full human beings and how rarely that happened. And then what happened, unfortunately, a lot of death when women weren't recognized as full human beings, specifically in terms of their healthcare needs, and how communities were so dependent on the supportive work that women did and also the community building work that women did. And when they had support, communities thrived. When they didn't have support, unfortunately, people died, but communities also suffered.
Mm-hmm. That kind of gets into this idea that I hadn't heard of before, that you refer to as social birth. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit. In your book, Birthing the West, you know, you tell this story of women who were kind of geographically isolated, far from their families and societal supports that they'd had back east. But they were tight-knit in their support of one another, even though they were sort of scattered. So I wonder, can you tell us a little bit about the idea of social birth and what that is and how women supported one another?
Absolutely. And it sounds very radical because it's very different than contemporary notions of birth. But even going back, say, 100 years ago or 200 years ago, if someone were to say, oh, I just went into labor or I'm having a baby, the last thing in the world anyone would think of would calling the doctor. They would say, oh, let's gather the friends and or gather the neighbors. You need people here. And so birth was not seen as a medical event. It was seen as a community event, a female community event largely. And so the worst thing for, especially if we're talking in this part of the country, the voices of women that I was able to excavate and find in the historical record, they were worried about being alone. They were not particularly fearful about childbirth itself, but they were afraid of being alone. And so they really came out for each other. So the idea of, you know, you should never be alone. And so traditionally, and this goes back throughout all of human history, because it has changed so dramatically how we give birth has changed so dramatically in recent history. But birth would be a time where women in the community got together, they would tell stories, some of them would be a little off color. It was a chance to have fun together and to celebrate this new baby and to be there for each other. Obviously, there was work to do, but it was seen as something that was totally routine, but also a really important part of community. So a lot of these women, and you know, this would be women of all ages, some of whom were past their childbearing ages and some who were yet to be in the process of being pregnant and having babies, but they were surrounded by birth, so they were experts in it. They knew what a normal childbirth situation looked like. They were aware of problems that would arise, and so it was really kind of a group of experts. Typically in our region of the country, because it was so scarcely populated, they couldn't have the larger social gatherings that might be common where there were a number of women. So it was usually, because people were so geographically spread out, a couple, two, three, etc., depending on whether they were out in the country, whether they were in a small town, etc. But it was seen as a time of coming together, not necessarily as a time of a need to call a medical practitioner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you mentioned, at that time, women, starting at a young age, they were really steeped in the mechanics of birthing. You know, whether it was livestock that they were caring for, family members. So there's this deeper pool of knowledge at the time, which challenged my assumptions about, you know, the pioneer West and women being on their own with no medical care, and how did they birth babies when, in fact, they had people present who were intimately connected with the experience of birthing and were well served by that.
Absolutely. And across the region, there was a whole spectrum, if I can call it that, in terms of birthing experience. So actually, a number of countries that a lot of immigrants came to this portion of the United States from, so some of those Northern European countries, had a tradition of midwifery training, actually state-sponsored. So a number of immigrants, say, coming from Norway or Sweden or Finland, came with midwifery degrees. They had textbooks, they had instruments, they actually had formal training in midwifery. So if you were a settler woman, you may have called on your neighbor and discovered that she had a long history of assisting with births. But even if people didn't have official training, as you mentioned, they were so connected to the mammalian process of birth. And so for anyone who, you know, has assisted with mammalian birth, even if it's just puppies or kittens, or I grew up on a ranch, so it was a lot of cows that I was familiar with. It's obviously somewhat different for humans, but there's also a tremendous amount of similarity. And so that whole process was something that they were really up to speed, so to speak, or experts in. And in the way that anymore we're so caught off from birth. I mean, I remember as a kid with my siblings, they just sort of appeared. I didn't see them get born. All of a sudden, there was just, you know, my little brother or my little sister. They just sort of came about out of thin air. That would have been so different historically, not just 150 years ago, but going back all through human history, because it would have been a process that people were aware of. And so if you were a 14-year-old girl helping out at a social birth with people gathered around, that would not have been your first birthing experience. It would have been like a multiple. You would have been present for all sorts of births, human and animal, and you would really understand what that process was about, both sort of the variety of quote-unquote normal birth, and then also the kinds of common issues that would come up that could cause problems or would need attention in terms of a troubled birth, so to speak.
We're in conversation with Dr. Jennifer Hill, as well as Jen Jackson Quintano. Dr. Hill is a professor, an associate teaching professor at Montana State University, and her book, Birthing the West, is the focus of our conversation here today, as well as she will be speaking at the Sandpoint Library for a presentation on May 10th from 5 to 7 p.m., sponsored by Friends of the Library, the Pro Voice Project, and the East Bonner County Library. What is the time period of the book that you're talking about, the years that it spans?
So obviously the history of childbirth goes back in perpetuity, back to the beginning of humans. I don't attempt to cover that. So the specific stories that I am telling in the specific historical context is really from about the 1860s all the way through the 1930s, 1940s. And this is unique to the American West in that the transition to hospital birth occurred in this region much later than it did in other parts of the United States. And so fortunately, these stories were actually available to us because it was that transition was delayed in this part of the country. Trying to tell this story in, say, the eastern part of the United States wouldn't be possible because the birth context had transitioned to the hospital at a much earlier date.
There's so much that I want to ask you about your research, but then I'm also, you know, I really want to get into part of the reason why we're having you come here, which, as you are aware and as our listeners are aware, last year we lost labor and delivery services at our hospital mm-hmm. here. And Idaho as a whole is facing an exodus of OBGYNs. We've lost nearly a quarter of practicing OBGYNs in the past 18 months. And we're just really feeling the impacts of legislating healthcare. And I think, as you have said, and as I've found, there's a lot that history can tell us, you know, our past can tell us about our present experience. And I wonder if you can speak a little bit to that, like the research that you've done, how you feel that relates to what we're seeing today in Idaho and in other states across the nation.
Sure. Well, there's some pretty clear parallels. Obviously, as a historian, I also always have to issue this caveat. We can never take the past and totally lay it over the present because everything changes. But there are ways that we can understand the historical context and then look for patterns in our present. And some of those are just so glaringly clear. If we look back at the time period and the particular geographic context that I was looking at in Birthing the West, the U.S. government wanted women to come and settle in the West. They wanted women to come and settle in the West because they were trying to accomplish this whole cultural project. What happened, though, was they wanted women, but not women in as full creatures, as people who had healthcare needs, people who would be reproducing. And what that created was this huge health crisis where we had women dying and babies dying because they were not seen in their full experience. And it is sadly a repeat of some of the things we're seeing now, where sure, women are citizens, sure, women are people, except not in this particular kind of care and not in this particular need that you might have. And unfortunately, that is something that history shows is just tremendously damaging. So even if there is a desired outcome now, like in certain states that want to legislate certain kinds of reproductive behavior, the body doesn't work that way. And so it's not possible. Like if you're going to attempt to only provide certain kinds of healthcare services for women or certain kinds of reproductive behavior, you're going to end up causing harm because people are full people. And the women of the American West in the time period that I was looking at had a whole slew of reproductive needs that they ended up turning to each other for, and they did their very best to provide care for each other, some of which was very successful, but could have been far more successful if there had been institutional and state support. And so at this time when reproductive care is under assault, it's as if the process of picking and choosing once again is happening. Instead of being able to access a full range of care, now it's a picking and choosing, which often takes all care off the table. Your folks' situation is a prime example of that. Not to be able to access reproductive care is a tragedy in a country that has these kinds of medical resources available. It's entirely backwards. And sadly, it's not just a funny historical blip. It means that real people will die. Real people will have health problems. And so it's the compartmentalization and the wishing that there can be certain reproductive outcomes that get approved and then other reproductive outcomes that don't get approved causes an absolute swath of destruction in terms of healthcare. What history shows us, the historical window that I was looking at, was that there was tremendous harm to communities when women weren't supported. When they died, there were children without parents. There were families without caregivers. There was just an overwhelming number of bad things that happened in the quest to get women out and get communities started. And it doesn't need to be that way. We actually have the knowledge and the resources to provide healthcare to a wide spectrum of women. We just can't pick and choose. Unfortunately, picking and choosing from the legislative level means that women in general are hurt, and that weakens communities across the board.
Absolutely. And that's what we're seeing here in Sandpoint, for sure. This has impacted women's health, but it's also impacted the health and vitality of the community. And we have a lot of young women here who are questioning whether this is where they want to be to raise a family, and whether this can support them. And I just go back to a phrase you used earlier about the recognition of women as full human beings. And within that fullness, you can't pick and choose what kind of health care you can offer a full human being. You need to offer the full spectrum, which in some cases includes abortion care, which is what Idaho has legislated against and is creating, as you said, a swath of destruction. when you mess with one portion of reproductive health care, you know, the whole edifice is affected. But I want to think about this idea, you know, recognizing women as full human beings and more than just the sum total of, you know, the number of children that they can bring into the world.
Absolutely.
And you talk about that a lot, the concept of a woman's worth. And that's actually what we'll be exploring with the Pro-Voice Project's Worth of a Woman exhibit that will be going up at the same time that your presentation is happening. But women are central to their families and their communities. So if you lose a woman, if you don't elevate her health, don't take care of all aspects of her health, and you lose her, you talk a lot in your book about the ripple effects from that. Are there some stories in particular that stand out from your research that sort of illustrate that?
Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of examples. Let me just pull one specifically. But I wish there were a paucity of examples, and unfortunately, there's a plethora of examples because so many women died needlessly. So I'm thinking about specifically, her name was Bertha, and she was of German extraction, and she and her husband had two young children, and she didn't get the reproductive care she needed. Basically, she died from an infection, and that could have been easily prevented. This is in the early 1900s. And what was tragic was the fact that as a result, her two little kids got taken to the orphanage. And then her extended family had to mobilize to try and figure out how they could create a home for these little kids. And it created this huge just ripple effect in terms of the support services that Bertha had been providing in the community, the people that she was involved with and cared about, but then also obviously in the lives of her kids. And then that came down generation to generation. One of the beautiful things about the research for this book was that a lot of the records I was using were not in any archival institution whatsoever, because people frankly didn't value them that much. And a lot of the resources that I used came from families who recognized that their mother, that their grandmother, their great-grandmother's experience was really valuable, and they wanted to protect that. And so Bertha's story came to me from her descendants, who talked about the ongoing impact of those two little girls being put in the orphanage. The father later remarried, actually married the sister of his dead wife initially, his first dead wife. And so those kids then got brought back home and got out of the orphanage. But their time period in the orphanage was absolutely traumatic for them. And that sadness and loss and just horrific upset came down through the generations. So the family members that I talked about how sad it was and how this had affected them decades and decades and decades later. So if you take that story and you magnify it over the course of an entire region, think about that across communities, across states, across regions, Bertha's story is just one of many, but it has such a tremendous impact. And it's very easy to look at that impact after the fact, but that's one of the things we can do now through the lens of history, is say, this is just needless death. This is needless sadness. This is needless work and worry that we don't have to have. We have the medical resources to make this possible so that we can avoid these kinds of situations. So that's one of many stories of this unfortunate kind of lack of care.
These, you know, as you look, so in the wake of publishing your book, and now you're seeing reproductive health care, specifically abortion, being debated in state houses and courthouses across the country. Is this impacting where you are turning your gaze and what your scholarship is going to look like moving forward? Or does it lend greater weight to the book that you've just put out recently? How does your work fit in with this current context, political context?
Well, if I wondered if all that work was worth it, it certainly validates the importance of recording these kinds of histories, because it has such a clear lesson. I think for me, there's an overwhelming sadness that, like, again, we're doing this again. How many times do we have to go through this pattern of seeing so much death and destruction simply because we can't support women's bodies, and we're going to try and control certain kinds of reproductive behaviors? It just doesn't work. And it's been shown not to work over and over and over again. So there's just an incredibly, the ignorance is, it's just sad. I feel sort of overwhelmed by it at times. But then I think the answer is to remind everyone, listen, we don't have to keep doing this. This does not make sense. This hasn't worked in the past. It's not going to work now. This is going to result in some really, really sad outcomes. And the unfortunate part is that the flip side is so easy and produces such good results in the situations when women can have access to a full range of health care, when they can have access to a full range of contraception, when they can have access to legitimate tested information about their bodies in all stages of life. they thrive. They are able to take care of their bodies, their families, their communities. If they have children, they're able to take care of those children. And so it is stunning to look at the positive results that can happen. And then it's incredibly sad and infuriating to see the negative results that can happen. So I think the contemporary situation has made me all the more committed to recognizing and valuing these kinds of stories, even though they're really they're harder to tell than, you know, the history of war. But probably greater in significance given the impact that they can have and given how important it is that we listen not only to the needs of women now, but to listen to the needs of women in the past, because they tell us so much about how we can have sustaining, loving, connected communities now.
Yeah, absolutely. It brings to mind, I had the opportunity to collect some contemporary birthing stories in the wake of our hospital, Bonner General, closing labor and delivery. It just felt really important to record women's stories of birthing there while it was still fresh in their minds, just so we wouldn't forget that we had that option once, because here we are a year later, and it almost feels normal that this is just the way things are. But one thing that I was struck with in those stories, and it goes back to something you mentioned earlier in our talk about relational experiences being the core of human meaning. Those stories, they weren't necessarily like, oh, thank God for the pain relief that I got there, or thank goodness for this particular intervention. It was a lot about thank goodness for this nurse or this doctor or this person that I encountered there, and how she or he, you know, really was there for me. And then also a lot of these stories are about how these doctors and nurses are an integral a part of our community, that, you know, our children grow up together and we coach soccer together. And so the loss of labor and delivery services at the hospital is much more than just the loss of particular medical care. It's a blow to the fabric of the community, too, because even though we don't have the same kind of social birth experience that we used to, in small towns like this, it still is something of a social birth event, because we have so many connections between us beyond just the doctor-patient binary.
Absolutely. And it's those kinds of things that in our economic system, we can't put a dollar value on, but they're transformative in terms of people feeling as if they are home, as if they are in a community that cares about them. A historical example, Mary Kassmeyer was a midwife in northern Montana, and her practice, obviously, she helped women deliver babies, but she knew those kids through their lifespan. And so in an era of high child mortality, she would show up for the funeral. There's a picture in the Birthing the West book of a kid who was 2 or 3 years old who died of an unrelated disease. And Mary Kassmeyer had been there at her birth, and she was there at the funeral, and she brought food, and she was there for the family. And whether it's in sadness or in joy, you know, seeing people at the grocery store that helped you through your birth or that know something about you, because we don't monetize that, we tend not to value it. But it makes all the difference in the world, especially in an era where loneliness is skyrocketing and people feel abandoned and isolated. It is absolutely those kind of connecting experiences that make us feel grounded and loved and at home. Those are the things that make people stick around in a community. Those are the things that make people invest in a community. Those are the kinds of things that make a community flourish.
Can I ask you something, just to get, this will take us kind of into the realm of speculation more than fact, but I am curious about why you had to kind of go, you had to comb through oral history hoping that somebody would mention childbirth, and there wasn't just an already existing, you know, textbook on how on how childbirth was done in really for all of human history, and then specifically for this time period. I'm thinking of the opposite experience would be death, and for that, I feel like we could just go back and look at. I mean, we know offhand that it's that when someone dies, you bury them 6 feet underground, and there will be a funeral followed by a wake, and there'll be, you know, I mean, depending on what community or what religion you are, but all these things, there's a known process for it, but for childbirth, for entering the world, it seems to be that these things weren't recorded or written down in the same way. Do you have a feeling on why that is?
Well, it's incredibly challenging to be able to put on the lens of someone from 200 years ago. But believe it or not, when someone was born, the first thought was not, we need to fill out a birth certificate. In fact, that was the last thought from anyone. I mean, now it seems completely logical to us because it's such a part of our life. But no one filled out forms. That was something that was initiated by state health departments who were trying to track their population. And they had an incredible struggle getting people to fill out a birth certificate. They created all sorts of incentives and punishments and tried to pay people to get them to fill out a birth certificate because people felt like it was an invasive act. Like, we're doing this thing that's a private family thing, a social thing. We're doing it with other people. Why in the world should the state government get us to tell them anything? Why in the world would we need to fill out a piece of paper? So that's an example of how a human perspective can change so quickly. So the recording of births, some people did it in like a family Bible or something like that, but otherwise it was very much about like you were who you were because of the people that knew you and the context you were in, the community you were in. So there wasn't that sort of statistical record keeping that is so familiar to us now. So the involvement of the government in recording who is born is a relatively recent invention and was also seen as wildly problematic by most people at that time. It took a couple decades for state governments, for health departments, to convince people that they really needed to report births. It was something that they met with a tremendous amount of resistance to. So it's not only a matter of that the official records didn't exist, but then in terms of researching about something so, in a sense, central to human life and experience, reproduction has also always lived within the female realm, and history about less than important groups, the people who don't write, the people who are not as wealthy, etc. It just, there's so many gaps in the historical record. So when you look at the absence of record keeping at the state level and then the sort of bias towards not recording women's activities, you get this lethal black hole when it comes to reproductive history.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I'm curious how what do we do to elevate this topic in this conversation moving forward so that your counterpart 150 years from now will have something more to look back on, something more defined than you did in your research?
Yeah, exactly what you're doing in terms of recording the experiences of people in your community who can't access or who did access healthcare there and then can't now. So it is just exactly that of saying, listen, this is significant. The other thing is to break the silences, the taboo that go with sort of anything related to reproduction, that it's a really normal thing. It's something that, as I mentioned before, that's how we all got here. And there are ways of normalizing it and talking about it without being purient, we can do it in ways that feel good to all sorts of people and feel right and proper without descending into Victorian era taboo about not mentioning anything to do with it, because it's important information. It is just basic biology that people need to understand in terms of how their bodies change over time, what that means in terms of all of their bodily systems, including their reproductive system. And so it is becoming conversant, talking about it. If people are willing to share their stories, that makes a huge difference. And having those stories there and recorded in a repository or somewhere where people can access them is a huge service to the future, because the experience, you know, as you mentioned, in terms of losing your healthcare options there locally, it gets normalized. And then it's really hard to go back and recreate, well, what was it like when we could, you know, get that kind of care here. And so doing the things that you're doing in terms of recording those histories, recording those stories, making those available is absolutely critical to have this topic continually be valued, to continue to remain part of the historical record.
Well, that's why I'm just so grateful that you are covering this topic and writing about it and speaking about it, because as you say, the silences, we need to break these silences. This is not a shameful thing to talk about. We need to be talking about healthcare, all kinds of healthcare, including reproductive healthcare. So I'm just so grateful that you came on the show with us today, that you're going to come and speak at the library on Friday, May 10th. And we can continue this conversation there. Anything else from you, Jack?
No, I mean, I'm so glad that Dr. Hill has taken the time. And this did turn into a longer conversation than I think I was even expecting. But we could, and it also feels like we could go on for,
I know.
we've just scratched the surface. But I guess that's why you're coming on May 10th.
Absolutely. Good to hear. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about a topic that I care very much about and is just, for me, and I think for so many people, so very interesting. So thank you both.
Dr. Jennifer Hill, her book is Birthing the West, and again, she'll be at the Sandpoint Library on May 10th at 5 p.m., and we will talk more about that after we end this conversation. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap things up here on the first chapter of our three-part series, Worth of a Woman. We're back. It's Jack Peterson. We're live here in the studio with Jen Jackson Quintano. Just for a few moments after that interesting conversation with Dr. Jennifer Hill, and as I guess we said right at the end of it there, it will be good to have her here on May 10th, because it does feel like that was just the beginning of a conversation. I look forward to her talk this Friday at the library.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She is so vibrant and alive and excited about her scholarly work. And I just think her talk is going to be incredible. So that's going to be this Friday, May 10th. The library large meeting room will be open at 5 for a reception with some light snacks and the unveiling of the Worth of a Woman exhibit. And then at 5:30, Dr. Hill will give her talk, and there will be time for a question and answer period after that, so the community can really engage more deeply with her on this topic.
The idea of it's so much of what she said there was new to me, was brand new. The idea of like social birth, kind of that picture of what things were like, presumably in this area as well as across the West, is very interesting. How the idea that you would act, that birth would not be so mysterious, perhaps even less mysterious than it is now, to the average person, that this would be a normal part of life that you'd be exposed to from a very early age, is very interesting, very different from the way things are today. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, it's really something that we've sort of siloed in this medical realm where we've abdicated our our agency around it. And of course, we need medical care, but also we need to be talking about this stuff more. When we've siloed it to the medical realm, it's like we stopped engaging on this topic. And that's what I'm really excited about with this Worth of a Woman exhibit, is to bring this back into the public sphere and really talk about women's needs, pregnant people's needs for reproductive health care.
You can, listeners can attend on May 10th at the East Bonner County Library. At 5 o'clock, Professor Jennifer Hill will be giving her talk. And then again at Bluebird Bakery will be the display starting on the 13th, correct?
Yes.
Which is...
Or the 12th, Mother's Day.
The 12th. Why did I get that wrong? I'm sorry. Yes, Mother's Day. That's this Sunday. Whoops. We better get our flowers. Okay. It is 9 o'clock. That hour flies by fast. We'll be back 1 week from today, bringing a little bit more local perspective to this issue, talking to some people from our community involved in the Pro Voice Project, as well as you'll be here again, Jen.
Correct.
And then the week after that, an economist and a legislator wrapping things up, talking about the worth of a woman. So stay tuned for that. And thanks for listening to 88.5 KRFY Pend Oreille. This is Panhandle Community Radio.